Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Wednesday, January 27, 2021. Producing from his home studio in the foothills of Connecticut, it's Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home studio here just north of New York City. And Taylor, wow. Hall of Fame voting results announced on Tuesday night. No one gets in, but there was a lot of conversation.
Oh, yeah. The talk was juicy. I think it's kind of a shame that we're not getting anyone in the Hall of Fame this year. Some people like the exclusivity of it. I think there's a lot of political axes being ground throughout this process. So we'll get into all of it today. It's going to be a good episode.
Yeah, we're going to be talking with Tim Kirkchin. We're going to be talking with Jeff Passan. Paul and Mikitis will stop by. And in the podcast today as well, we're going to have Jim Palmer. And he's going to give us stories about the many Hall of Famers who have passed away in the last calendar year. It's been an incredible year of loss for that really close-knit group of current Hall of Famers. Last night's voting, Curt Schilling had the highest vote count, 71.1%. But that, of course, is short of the 75% needed to get in. After the voting results were announced, Curt Schilling released a Facebook post that he'd sent to the Hall of Fame, basically asking that he be taken off the ballot next year in his last year of eligibility. I'm paraphrasing here. He basically was indicating that he doesn't think the writers, he doesn't want to be judged by the writers. He'd rather be judged by a veterans committee, which is comprised mostly of his peers. Barry Bonds got 61.8%, Roger Clemens 61.6%. They have basically not moved in any of the voting in recent years, voting percentages. By the way, about Schilling's post, Hall of Fame board chairman Jane Forbes Clark said in a statement that the board will consider the request at our next meeting. Since we last talked, a bunch of moves. The Philadelphia Phillies yesterday agreed to a five-year, $115.5 million deal with catcher JT Realmuto. It's the biggest contract ever agreed to by a free agent catcher. The Blue Jays continue to be busy. They agreed to a deal with Marcus Semien to 1 year and $18 million. Of course, they added George Springer last week. So they've been going crazy. The Nationals agreed to sign closer Brad Hand, Jay Happ, Andrelton Simmons to the Twins, Tommy La Stella to the San Francisco Giants, and Michael Brantley to the Astros on a two-year, $32 million deal. And the Yankees the other day traded for pitcher Jameson Taillon. Before we get to Tim, to Jeff, to Jim Palmer, and to Hembo, two things I want to mention. Check out Marvel Studios' WandaVision, the original series, now streaming only on Disney+. And listen to Keyshawn, J. Will, and Zubin weekday mornings on ESPN Radio. I was on with them this morning talking about Hall of Fame stuff. They go from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern, or search for, download, and subscribe to Keyshawn, J. Will, and Zubin wherever you get your podcast.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code BASEBALL. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes, the clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, 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 with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
Team heads rejoice.
Nerd alert!
It's Timmy time.
Is this a great game or what?
With Tim Kirkchin on Baseball Tonight.
And Tim Kirkchin covers baseball for ESPN. And last night, Tim, nobody gets voted to the Hall of Fame as we expected. Isn't voting for the Hall of Fame fun for you?
It's still, Buster, without being corny,
okay,
the biggest honor and the biggest privilege I have, but it's not very much fun anymore. There are no more right answers, Buster. Every time I hand in my ballot, I'm unsatisfied. I know I didn't do it right, but I know I didn't do it wrong either. There are no more right answers anymore. And sorry, it's just really disturbing and discouraging that on a day where baseball should be celebrating something great, a day that's supposed to be a great day turns into so much hate and so much anger directed at the players, at the media. It's just, it's not that it's not important, because it is. And I'm not saying people should have gone in yesterday and it's the only way for something good to happen. But on a day when baseball should be celebrating, the opposite happened. Maybe I'm seeing it all wrong, but it should be more fun than this. That's for sure.
Let's break this down a little bit. First off, I mean, you and I are kind of in a weird position when it comes to Curt Schilling to some degree, because we both worked with him. I worked with him on Sunday Night Baseball. You worked with him on Baseball Tonight. What did you think of how his day progressed from, first off, not getting voted in, despite the fact that he was really close last year? I don't think there's any question that for some voters, his tweets, the things he said on social media turned out to be disqualifying and probably cost Curt an election to the Hall of Fame this year, or was the difference between him being voted in or not. And then by the end of the day, Curt releasing the Facebook post that he sent to the Hall of Fame saying that he didn't want to be considered next year. What did you make of his day?
Well, you're right, Buster. It puts a lot of people in a difficult spot. For what it's worth, I covered his major league debut. I've known him for a long time. He was a teammate of mine at ESPN, and that stuff still matters to me when I'm a teammate with somebody. But things have changed with him, and I'm not surprised that he didn't get in. I would have been surprised if he had this year based on how active he's been on social media. I know at least two of my friends told me, I'm not voting for him because of what he said. And I voted for Curt Schilling. I'm voting for him based on the way he pitched 10 years ago, 20 years ago, not on his political stances or the way he views the world today. That's why I voted for him. But now with what he came out and said and went after the baseball writers, never a good idea, by the way, I don't see any way that even if he's on the ballot next year, that he's getting in through the writers' ballot. He will take his chance with the Veterans Committee. Maybe he's right. Maybe he'll have a much better chance there. I've been on those committees, Buster. I'm not positive that those committees are easier to get through than the writers, but I guess we'll see, perhaps.
How do you think the Hall of Fame should handle his request to be taken off the ballot next year?
I think the Hall should say, this is our club. This is the baseball writers are in charge of this. And we, the Hall is in charge of this. We'll determine if we're going to take you off the ballot. So I think he'll be on the ballot, I'm guessing, but I think he'll be on the ballot. And then it'll be real interesting to see where he goes from there.
I remember talking with you about 4 years ago when Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds were all polling at about the 58% mark. And I'm wrong a lot more than you are. But I remember at that time, I think you and I disagreed, where I was like, do you think that these guys will get in? And you felt like, yeah, eventually over time, you know, the voting block will change. And Tim, I've thought all along, look, it's pretty clear that there's about, you know, 35, 36, 37% of the writers who are saying these two guys don't pass the character clause for us. Their numbers haven't moved at all in the last few years.
Right. And again, Buster, I'm not sure if you've been right or wrong more than me, but I know this, you were right about that. I thought with the way things were moving, for them to go from mid 30s to high 50s, that was a signal that they were going to get in after 10 years. But you're right. The last couple of years, it's really slow. And this year, Buster, with no first-timers on the ballot that just overwhelmed you, this was the opening for them to get a spike in the voting. And they didn't. They got a very, very small increase. And now they're looking at picking up 13, 14, almost 15% of the vote in their final year eligible, which has been done before. Four different players got over 15% in their final year on the ballot in order to make it to the Hall of Fame. Larry Walker got 22% more in the final year, but those guys don't have the baggage that Clemens and Bonds do. And you're absolutely right, Buster. There is a faction of writers who say, if you have a connection to PEDs on any level, you're not getting in on my ballot. And we're at roughly 30, almost 40% there. And that's a big number.
And you and I have talked about this before. I find that to be absurd because there are already players in the Hall of Fame who took PEDs. And I don't understand. I think there's no question the reason why those two guys are singled out in a way that others aren't is that they were the best players of the era, so they get more scrutiny. I mean, there were literally thousands of other players in the major league and minor leagues under baseball's umbrella who were doing the exact same thing, but these two guys are pulled off to the side. You know, we start off by talking about, you know, how this has progressed, and last night on social media it was so ugly. And I tweeted out today, Tim, something I've really come to believe, that it's time for the writers to go to the Hall of Fame as a collective body and say, you know what? You guys apply the character clause. You decide whether or not you want Curt Schilling or, you know, someone who's accused of domestic violence like Omar Vizquel, the PED guys. Let the Hall of Fame put that onus on the Hall of Fame and say, you guys decide whether or not they pass your character clause. And if and come out and make that declaration and then put the players on the ballot at that point. But I think the writers need to tell the Hall of Fame, you guys make that decision. It's your Hall of Fame. It's your plaques. It's your process.
Yeah. And, you know, I've said this many times, Buster, I'm not comfortable being the moral arbiter in all of these cases. And the writers need some help. The steroid era itself dumped a gigantic issue right in the laps of the writers and said, okay, you guys figure this out. And frankly, we're not good enough to figure this out. Nobody's good enough to figure this out. We need a nationwide discussion led by the Hall, former players, Hall of Famers, and try to figure out what we're supposed to do here. Because the writers get crushed over this, that, you know, we're doing the wrong thing or we're doing the right thing. There are no more right answers, Buster. We need help from the Hall and from others, because this is such a weighty problem that leads to such hatred on the day that's supposed to be a celebration. That's my concern, and I'm with you. Please, somebody help us out with this process. It is very, very difficult.
So moving forward, and I wrote about this in 2016 about how I really felt at that time, and I really believe it now, that we're face to face with it, that David Ortiz's candidacy is going to be a really interesting litmus test for a lot of the voters who to this point have said, I'm not voting for Bonds, I'm not voting for Clemens. Because as you know, David Ortiz, so beloved, a great leader. We remember him after the Boston Marathon bombing, how he pulled that community together. Someone who's so well liked, he was named in a New York Times report, I want to say about 13, 14 years ago, that he tested positive in the survey testing in 2003. And I don't know how a lot of the voters, you know, if the voters who haven't voted for Clemens and Bonds say, well, I'm going to vote for David Ortiz. I don't know what the logic is behind that, Tim. So I think David Ortiz is just the fact that he's coming up on the ballot is going to spur a lot of conversation about how this should be handled. What do you think?
Right. And again, Buster, this is all we've been talking about for 10 years since Bonds and Clemens went on the ballot. And we're going to continue it even more next year in their final year on the ballot. First year for Alex Rodriguez and the David Ortiz situation. You're absolutely right. And David Ortiz is beloved, and he's going to get extra votes because of that. But if you're going to apply the same standards to Bonds and Clemens and anyone else that you suspect, then I guess the same thing has to go for David Ortiz. So there's going to be another real test in this very thorny problem next year, maybe the biggest test of all. And again, we need some help on some guidelines and some parameters here, because frankly, I struggle so badly with my ballot every year, what to do. And it's just help is necessary. Please.
I got three more for you. First off, start with this. Besides the three guys we've been talking about, Schilling, Bonds, and Clemens, was there anybody who jumped out at you in terms of his movement on yesterday's voting?
Yeah, well, obviously Scott Rolen got the biggest spike. He went up 17%. I voted for Scott Rolen. I've voted for Scott Rolen, and I think he's a Hall of Famer. I don't think he's a slam dunk, but Buster, defensive third baseman that I've seen in my life, for what it's worth, Brooks Robinson, Nolan Arenado, Scott Rolen. Plus, he hit the middle of the order for much of his career, played the game the right way, and even though he missed a bunch of games, he was a little bit more durable than people give him credit for, especially for a 10-year period there in his prime. So I think this is a really good sign for Scott Rolen that he's got five more shots at this, and he's already over 50%. And history tells us if you get over 50% with the writers, eventually the chances are really good you're going to get in, and that's where I think we're going with Scott Rolen.
So I worked on a story. It's coming out, I think, on Thursday, where I asked a lot of rival evaluators, what do you think of what the Yankees have done this offseason? I'll pose that question with you, Tim, because it looks like their major lifting is over other than maybe signing Brett Gardner. What do you think of what the Yankees have done this winter?
Well, I think they've done okay. Not great, but they have a really good team if they don't do anything. Now, they have to get some people healthy. They have to upgrade their starting pitching, which they've tried now in so many different ways. Jameson Taillon now, Corey Kluber. I think it's the way to go. I think it's the thing to do. They are truly hoping that some things work out, but this was the best way to go about it, and I think they'll be the best team in the American League East this year. And with a lot of things going wrong last year from injuries on down, I don't think they are going to, and I don't think they have to make a massive move before spring training or before the season starts to be the odds-on favorite to win the East. But we'll see where they are in late July, assuming we play 162, and I fully expect them to do something to upgrade. But I really like the creativity they've shown here, as risky as it is, with some guys they brought in.
Yeah, and that was a lot of the feedback I got from other teams where they were like, you know, this is their window to win right now, and yet they have a lot of risk in that rotation. You know, the Yankees' belief internally is, yeah, there's risk. Clearly, you know, someone with the injury, recent injury history of Corey Kluber, Jameson Taillon and his injuries, but their feeling is also, if these guys hit, their ceiling is going to be really high. Last one, how close are the Blue Jays to the Yankees in your mind after signing George Springer, after adding Marcus Semien, with all those young players that they're developing?
Well, I love what the Blue Jays have done. The White Sox and Blue Jays, obviously, two most improved teams in the American League in this offseason. Semien can play second base. I'm pretty sure about that. They can keep Vlad Guerrero at first. They can move Kevin Biggio to third. George Springer adds an enormous element in center field, freakish athlete, tremendous leadoff guy with power and speed, and just another reminder, hey, the Blue Jays are serious now. They just gave him all that money. They've upgraded their bullpen. They've added some interesting pieces to the rotation. I still don't think their starting pitching is good enough right now to win that division, but it's impossible to not like what the Blue Jays have done this winter.
All right, Tim. Well, I'm rooting, because I don't vote, I am rooting it for the process to be easier for you, because you're such a good person. I know you're tortured by this.
Well, it's very, very difficult. I need no sympathy. I want no sympathy. I just want the process to work better than it is right now. And that's why I think you're right. We need to talk about this.
Jeff Passan covers baseball for ESPN. And Jeff, I stopped voting in 2015 for the Hall of Fame. You stopped a few years ago. I bet you last night, as you were watching all that play out, you were glad that you were not involved, because I know I was.
I was so appreciative when you did that, Buster, because it kind of carved the path for the rest of us who had reticence about our Hall of Fame votes. And I mean, you know, you're at ESPN, you're on TV all the time, you're one of the foremost voices in the industry, and you drop your Hall of Fame vote. And I think it made a lot of us think to ourselves, why are we doing this? What's the rationale behind it? What's the reason behind it? And to see it turn into the show that it did last night, it's not surprising, because this whole thing, since PED players in particular got on the ballot, has gone back to a character clause that shouldn't exist in the first place, that just should not exist. In my whole thing, you know, at the time I didn't recognize this, but as it has gone on, if we are going to penalize people for supposed character values, why don't we look at guys like Dale Murphy, whose character was absolutely above and beyond, and give them additional weight and value? And the answer, of course, is because we really don't know who these people are as much time as we spend with them, as much as we talk with them. I think the Jared Porter situation pretty much illustrated that as well as anything, a guy who's beloved in the industry. And so if we are applying something only one way, that shows a great amount of bias. And to me, it shows why the flaw of the character clause is so abundantly clear. And it should just be abolished for the sake of the Hall, for the sake of baseball, and for the sake of these players who deserve to be in.
Yeah, and they deserve to be judged on the basis of their baseball careers. And you mentioned about the character clause being abolished. It was obsolete, as you know, for like 60 years. It wasn't a factor at all.
No.
It's the slipperiest of slopes. And, you know, it was ignored for 60 years or so. And then Mark McGwire's name hits the ballot in, what, 2006? And then that completely changed. And, of course, you know, I was just sort of laughing at the great irony this winter. That the character clause, you know, the writers have bent over backwards trying to figure out what to do with those words since McGwire first appeared in the ballot and the PED guys. It's believed that the character clause was put together by Kennesaw Mountain Landis, a commissioner who kept baseball segregated, worked to keep baseball segregated, and whose name was stripped off the writer's primary award just last summer. And so you're going to have the character standard described by that person. Which is why I tweeted out this morning. I'm curious to see what you think. I think the time has come for the writers collectively to go to the Hall of Fame and say, you know what? We're out of the character business. You decide whether or not these players pass your character test. You decide on Bonds. You decide on Clemens. You decide on Curt Schilling, you know, Omar Vizquel, and you declare it and make it clear to everybody, as far as we're concerned, these players have passed our character test, and then pass the names that get through that onto the writers. If I'm the writers, I'm going to the Hall of Fame. So, like, we are done with this. What do you think?
The last time the writers went to the Hall of Fame and asked for something, it was to expand the ballot from 10 to 12. And it was to do that because there was such a logjam, because the character clause was keeping PED users out of the Hall of Fame. And the Hall pretty much said no. And at that point, it was pretty clear to me that the Hall of Fame looks at the writers as patsies. It looks at the writers as the people who do the dirty work and who can take the blame. And the Hall can sit there and be its typical pristine self-reverent self. And the idea that the writers, and this is unfortunate because I think the writers are an important part of the process. You know, I see the BBWA last night getting ripped up and down, Curt Schilling going after it and saying, I want to be judged by the people who actually know. Listen, the writers are an imperfect group. There's no question about that. But the idea the players are big Hall person, then you want players voting, because it's not just that they'll vote for their friends. They'll vote for, you know, sort of marginal borderline guys just because they played against them and they saw them as somebody who was, you know, who they feared. I'm not a big Hall guy. I've never been a big Hall guy. I think the Hall of Fame exists to honor the greatest of the great. And so if you want to see the Hall of Fame expanded, by all means, take it away from the writers, give it to the players. They will ignore history. And I would say that players will not spend one-tenth as much time looking over their ballots as I think the average writer does. And I'm sure as you did when you were voting, and as I certainly did when I was.
I always love to tell this story because people will say that, you know, let the players do it. And I'm like, have you ever looked at the players' votes on some of these things, or let the coaches do it? And my favorite story, I used to, when the Sporting News was involved, and I don't know if they still are, but involved in the Gold Gloves. You know, I was a correspondent for the Sporting News, and they sent out the Gold Glove ballots. And they like, can you please go and talk to the coaching staff and get their votes on the Gold Glove? And so I took the ballots into the coach's room when I was covering the Padres at the time, I think. And they're filling it out like in 5 minutes. And one of the coaches yells at, hey, who's a good right fielder? And then somebody yelled out a name. And then everyone in the room wrote down that one name. And you know, and I know that whatever process you pick, it's going to be imperfect. We saw the Harold Bain election a couple of years ago. And I got to say, I agree with you. Last night, when you see the BBWA ripped up and down, I think of like people like my old friend Jason Stark, and how much he agonizes over this. And I think of someone like Tim, who we just talked to, and it's ridiculous to think that the writers don't take this seriously. The vast majority of them do. I do think we have reached the point for those who participate. They need more guidance from the Hall of Fame, as much as the Hall may want to use them as human sandbags that they stack up in front of them.
I think the only problem with that, Buster, and this gets back to why I gave up my vote a few years ago, was after the Joe Morgan letter, where even though there were PED users in the Hall at the time, Joe Morgan came out vociferously against PED use, and the Hall of Fame itself sent the email out. I think what the Hall wants itself to be and what writers necessarily believe the Hall should be are two different things.
Right.
And it's that difference in vision where I wonder if it is going to be incompatible going forward.
All right, let's talk about JT Realmuto signs with the Philadelphia Phillies yesterday in this winter of musical chairs. It seemed inevitable that he was going to wind up back in Philadelphia, especially after the Mets signed James McCann and the Yankees made it clear they were not going to look to upgrade past Gary Sanchez. What'd you think?
I think it's interesting looking back in hindsight now at how JT Realmuto probably should have been a Met. I mean, if he was going to end up at $115 million, which was around the range where it was expected, remember, he came out wanting $200 million. It became pretty clear early on that that wasn't going to happen. But the marginal difference between James McCann and JT Realmuto being $75 million, seeing the rest of the way that the winter has unfolded for the Mets. Now, maybe they go out and get Trevor Bauer. And that changes their calculus. I think, as much as anyone can say with Bauer, maybe the Mets are the favorite at this point. His free agency has been really weird. But the Phillies get the guy that they needed to get. I still don't know, Buster, if they're a good baseball team. I think they're a better team now. I like Aaron Nola in that rotation. I like Zach Wheeler. I think Alec Boehm is fantastic. And Bryce Harper had a great year last year. And bringing Realmuto back helps. And maybe with the expanded playoffs, this is a playoff team. Don't think they're as good as the Braves. Don't think they're as good as the Mets. We saw the Marlins' ascendance last year. And I think their pitching in particular, they have a chance to be good again. Like the NL East is a meat grinder of a division. And that's not to say the Washington Nationals, who remember won the World Series a couple of years ago and went out and got Josh Bell this offseason and have upgraded as well. So I just look at the Phillies right now and I don't think they're a good enough team right now, even with Realmuto.
I agree with you. I think I understand why they did it. And I think they needed to do something. They either needed to build up or tear down. To do nothing, to just hold the team as it was and not sign JT back, I think would have been a mistake. They either had to completely break it down, given the
And they're not doing that.
No. Right. So you got to push forward. And you know, people who've known David Dombrowski a long time have said he has this unique ability to convince owners to spend money. And he did in this case. You mentioned Bauer. It does feel like that the Mets and Bauer, like they're the only ones left at the party at 2 a.m., right? Like I can't see where else Trevor's going to get paid in a way that, you know, he should expect to want to get paid after a Cy Young season.
I mean, do the Blue Jays like quadruple down? Probably not after paying $18 million for Marcus Simeon. you know, there are questions about whether Bauer wants to go to the Los Angeles Angels. I think if the money's right, he probably would at this point, but you never know. The Dodgers, Buster, are just lurking. They're just lurking. You know, you talk about the last one at the bar at 2 a.m. The Dodgers are just sitting there nursing their beer very quietly, you know, no fuss, no muss. They got this big ring on their finger right now. And they know that Trevor Bauer is a competitor. They know that Trevor Bauer, for all the things that he does, you know, for all of the brand building that is important to him and social media that excites him and making up pitches and all those things, he's still a competitor and he wants to win a World Series ring. And there's no better place right now to do it than with the Dodgers. Now, is it worth giving up potentially goo gobs of money to do it? That's, you know, he's the one who said, I'll take a short-term deal. So it's going to be fascinating to see where this next week, I think probably next week or so, because look, spring training is like around the corner.
Yeah, exactly. And if he does sign with the Dodgers, I think you and I would agree it would be on some sort of a one-year deal. Maybe they structure it with a mutual option, which allow the Dodgers right to defer some of the cost. But it does feel like if he actually did sign with the Dodgers, look, Andrew Friedman does not give out a lot of long-term deals to free agents. Give me 90 seconds on what the labor situation is, speaking of spring training.
The labor situation is the same as it was last year, which is to say that it is long-term untenable. It is barreling towards some kind of a work stoppage after this upcoming season, and that the sides simply neither like nor trust one another, and that's not changing anytime soon. And that's I think, is the most frustrating part of this whole thing to baseball fans and even people inside the industry, that the sides are intractable in their positions. I mean, they believe that they are right, and not just right as in correct, but right as in morally as well, that the positions that they're staking out right now are what's best for the game going forward. And that players, if they are empowered, if they are paid as they're supposed to be, if they are the ones driving the economic engine, that they should get that accordingly. And they should be in greater positions of power than they are right now. And Major League Baseball and Rob Manfred believe that, you know, they are the ones who are guiding this game and have all the reason and right to guide this game in the direction that they believe it should go in. And when you have these two trains that are running on, they should be running on parallel tracks with one another. They are in diametric opposition right now. And you know what that winds up with? A train crash. That's what we're going toward right now. And it may be in the next month. It may be a few months down the road, but it feels almost inevitable at this point.
Yeah. It's like the Hall of Fame voting. It just, you can see this coming a long way away, which is why you and I got to sit it out last night.
Amen to that.
All right. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you, Buster.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Jim Palmer was voted the Hall of Fame in 1990 after a career in which he won 3 Cy Young Awards, and you know him as a broadcaster with the Baltimore Orioles. Jim, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Good to be with you.
I wanted to reach out to you because after Henry Aaron passed away last week, I just was thinking about, you know, my favorite thing, my favorite conversation with the Hall of Famers is always about their conversations with their peers at the Hall of Fame. And my goodness, in the last year, the loss of so many of your peers in the Hall of Fame, Al Kaline and Bob Gibson, Joe Morgan, Phil Niekro, Lou Brock, Don Sutton, Tom Seaver. And I just thought whenever the next ceremony is, and hopefully it's going to be this July, it's just going to seem so different. You know, I'm sure among your brethren, you probably feel the same way.
Well, yeah, you do. And, you know, Joe Morgan and I both got in, you know, we were inducted in 1990. And, you know, I mean, marvelous player, a couple MVPs. I only threw two leadoff home runs in my career. One was to Tommy Agee in the 69 World Series when he hit it over some Vietnam veterans in left field. They thought they were back in Vietnam. And then the other one was in the 77 All-Star game. You know, Bob Fischel, who was the assistant to Lee McPhail, said, "We don't want what happened last year happening this year." And I said, "Well, I won a Cy Young last year, but I didn't make the All-Star team. What don't you want happening?" He said, "You need to be ready to pitch at 8:20. Well, the game started at 8:45. And I went 3-2 in Joe Morgan. And I go, you know, if I walk him, he's going to steal second. And if he feels really peppy, he's going to steal third. So he had a pop fly down the right field line and in Yankee Stadium. And it used to be, what, I think 308 down the right field line. So there's your leadoff home run. But, you know, the thing about Joe is that, you know, we get in 1990 and we get rained out and we have to do it in a little gymnasium. And, you know, 10, 15 years afterwards, he'd always say, he said, "Thank God you spoke first." And I said, "Joe, you spoke first." So you get an idea of how nervous you are. You know, when you kind of want to go back and you want to thank all the people and you know, all the memories you've had and whatever. But I mean, you know, it's great to be inducted in. But Buster, what happened was because of the rainout, we actually got to go to the dinner that you normally have after everybody's inducted. And they passed the microphone around. And what I remember so vividly is that Ted Williams grabbed the microphone and he started talking about Stan the Man Musial. And he said, "You know, it's so great to see Stan back. You know, he'd had some health problems, so I guess he hadn't been there in 1989. And he said, "You know," and then Yogi talked, and, you know, I mean, DiMaggio's there and Mantle's there. I mean, you know, all the guys you idolized growing up and wanted to emulate and be like. And that's when I realized how close a family it is. So when you talk about, you know, going to the Hall of Fame, you know, it is a family and it is a team in a sense. You know, obviously the best players or at least arguably the best players that ever played. But, you know, I mean, I played for one organization, so I know how great friendships are. And the other thing is you get to see these guys in a little different light. You're not trying to get them out or you're, you know, not trying to beat them and you're not trying to compete against them. So it's a very special time.
Give me a story about Al Kaline.
Well, I have a couple, you know. First of all, I mean, you would not find a nicer guy. I always used to put the Tigers on my schedule because he, you know, even after he played and, you know, what, I think he had 399 home runs and hit, you know, 3,000 hits, got his 300 hit in Baltimore off Dave McNally. Dave dreamed about it, you know, I think about 3 weeks earlier, and then Al got the base hit. And he was a Baltimore kid, so, you know, I always knew about him. I mean, even when I was growing up, I think he won a batting title when he was like 19 or 20 or whatever. But a class guy. And my first start, I started against the Tigers and Denny McLain. And, you know, I'd come out of spring training really as a bullpen guy because I was 19, kind of had to be with the ball club. So I get a start. And first time up, I throw Al a couple fastballs and threw pretty hard. And I didn't have a slider. And he strikes out on three pitches. And he comes up, Dick Brown's the catcher, and fastball, curveball, strike one, strike two, and Dick puts down changeup. I didn't have a very good changeup, and I found that to be the case because Al hit it off the foul pole for a home run down the left field line in Baltimore. And then I threw him about a 97 or 8-mile-per-hour fastball low and away, and he hit a single into right field. And I think it was a learning experience, Buster. For the first time, I realized this guy's better than I am. So I better be able to get Norm Cash out and all these other guys because I do not want to pitch to Al Kaline. But probably the most poignant thing is the Tigers were in town when they had the statues in 2012, and mine was in August. And Al calls me and he said, "Do you mind if I come to the ceremony?" And I said, "You're Al Kaline." Of course. So we came to the luncheon and he was on the field when my stepson, who has autism, Spencer, ran out and actually introduced, you know, he ran out. I mean, he was 15 years old. All my friends were saying, you're not really going to let him do that. I said, no, he wants to do it. So, you know, he came out, he said, let's hear it for number 22, still the greatest, the most amazing, Jim Palmer. No, that's exactly what he told me to say, Jim Palmer. So when I come off, you know, Al says, that was really amazing. 2 weeks later at the Hall of Fame, and speaking about what you were talking about, Al comes up to me and he says, you know, he said, that was one of the greatest things that I ever saw in my life. He said, I still tear up when I think about your stepson with autism running out on the field and introducing you. So he was a, you know, great ball player, but what a guy. And, you know, so, you know, Louisa, his wife, was so nice and so cordial. And you really miss players like that.
Bob Gibson.
Well, you know, Gibby, I used to be on the board of the baseball assistance team. And we would arguably, you know, we'd go out and, you know, Tim McCarver, and we'd go out the night before the dinner. It was usually on a Tuesday night in New York. They'd have 1,300 to 1,500 people. It was kind of an autograph session. They'd sell your table if you were in the Hall of Fame for more, and they'd raise money for indigent former Negro League players, umpires, minor league players. And you'd also have about 100 players there. So you get to see guys you hadn't seen in years. You know, you didn't even hardly recognize because we'd all aged and we weren't wearing uniforms and all that. So I looked at McCarver and I said, you know, I would have loved to have been Bob Gibson's teammate because he just, you know, I mean, I remember the 17 strikeouts against what the Red Sox on 2 days rest or whatever it was in the 67 World Series. I mean, in spring training one time, I mean, I would go over to St. Petersburg and he's pitching and it's early in the spring. And it used to take me 7 starts to get my arm stretched out and all. And he's throwing about 100 miles per hour. So I'm running later and I see him and I said, what was that about? How do you do that? He goes, well, it's going to hurt all spring. I might as well get it out of the way early. But we go to lunch the day of Smith and Wolensky's. And it's Larry Christensen, Tim McCarver, Tug McGraw, Steve Carlton, Tim McCarver, and myself. And I'm just sitting there. I'm just kind of enjoying the, you know, they're National League guys. And Steve Carlton slides his chair back and looks across the table and he goes, there's the guy, pointing at Bob Gibson, that wrote the book on intimidation. And, wow. You know, I'd heard stories, all-star games, he wouldn't even talk to, you know, his National League teammates because he's going to have to get him out. But marvelous guy, great sense of humor, you know, and just one of a kind.
Phil Niekro.
Well, you know, it's funny. I didn't know that much about Phil other than the fact I couldn't throw a knuckleballer. You know, I hit off of Hoyt Wilhelm when I was 19 years old. I thought I had all those knuckleballs figured out. And then one that kind of fluttered right around my bat in Chicago. You know, he ended up in the Hall of Fame, actually pitched a no-hitter for the Orioles. But I did a Monday night game, you know, because I worked at ABC and did the World Series in Monday Night Baseball. And I think he might have been pitching with the Yankees. He beat the Tigers 1-0. And I was amazed. Because, you know, here's a guy that wins, you know, well over 300 games and, you know, pitches by what, 5,000 innings or whatever it was, pitches forever. And you think, geez, you know, he's just kind of a freak because he throws a knuckleball. But he had a great slider. He had, you know, pinpoint control with his fastball. Great athlete, great fielder. And, you know, again, as you said, you don't really get to meet those guys until afterwards. And then you realize, you know, this guy, I mean, it's amazing that he could do what he did. I mean, if you ever try to throw a knuckleball, it's almost impossible. You know, how many pitchers can do it? I mean, I once saw Tim Wakefield, who won over 200 games, strike out 3 guys on 77 mile per hour fastballs in the same inning. I mean, struck out the side, you know, just throwing fastballs. And that's what Philly Niekro could do. And, you know, kind guy, nice guy, quiet guy. But again, when you win over 300 games, it's just amazing. When I used to be on the Veterans Committee, how some of the baseball executives, you know, talking about Tommy John with over 280 some wins and, you know, Jim Cott, they go, well, you didn't have that many good years. When you win 300, I think Phil won, 318 games or something like that, you can really pitch. And just think about not only the physical part of pitching, but the mental part of pitching all those years.
Yeah, and I've always loved to hear the stories of brotherhood among the knuckleballers. What about Lou Brock?
Well, you know, it's funny, you know, again, another National League guy. I mean, I know, you know, other than Ricky Henderson, nobody stole more lifetime bases. And I remember, I mean, you know, when I was a kid, you know, Lou Brock, he gets traded from the Cubs to St. Louis or something. He hits one 440 feet, but he wasn't a home run guy. I think he hit under 200 home runs in his career. But what I remember is, you know, we lose to the Mets in 69, and we go to, you know, Earl Weaver's like a jockey coming down the stretch at Preakness, and we're in spring training, and we go to St. Petersburg, and Tom Phoebus is pitching for us, and Veda Pinson's leading off that day. Brock is, you know, we're playing in the old ballpark in St. Petersburg, and Tommy had a big overhand curveball, and he throws Veda Pinson, who was something like 2,800 hits. He throws him a hanging curveball, and he hits it off the screen down the right field line for a double. And Weaver, you know, what I remember is they'd put in new benches, and Earl's, you know, was so short at 5'6", his feet were dangling. They didn't even hit the cement. So he's yelling, and here comes Lou Brock. And if you had to imagine, you're looking across home plate from the third base dugout, and then Lou's coming up the plate, and Earl stands up and he says, "Take that curveball and shove it up your rear end," to Phoebus. And Lou's eyes get like this, and the first pitch is a high fastball. I swear to God, it's a high fastball about eye high. He hit it about 450 feet over the screen. So, of course, I had that love-hate relationship with Earl. And I walked down. I said, "You think he didn't know it was coming, Earl? Shove that curveball up here or whatever." So, anyway, you know, again, and it's funny because when Bruce Mano was our assistant general manager, when he went to the Cardinals, he said, "Hey, I want you to come up to Jupiter and talk to our pitchers." I said, "What? You want me to go talk to the Cardinal pitchers?" I said, "You got Bob Gibson, you know, you got all these guys up there." So I went up there for him because he was a good guy. And, you know, I thought maybe I could make a difference. And anyway, Lou Brock is standing around, and Bill Campbell, who had been a great pitcher, 1 year, I think he won 18 games out of the bullpen or something like that. But best when you pitch 2-3 innings. And he'd also had, next year he had 37 saves. So, you know, I talked and I said, "Who's the best righty and lefty in the, in the National League?" And they go, "Oh, you know, Schilling and Johnson." I said, no, "Over the last 15 years. "Oh, Maddox and Glavin." And I said, "So how many of you guys throw 90? Everybody's hand went up. And I said, what do they do that you can't do? And they said, "Well, you can, you know, throw a change up in any count, throw the ball low and away whenever they want to, field their position, bunt, do all the things you need to do as a National League hitter." And then I said, "Do you guys know who Bill Campbell is?" And they said, "Yeah, he's our double-A pitching coach." I said, no. "You know who Bill Campbell is?" I said, "Do you know that, you know, he won 18 games 1 year out of the bullpen, and the next year he had 37 saves?" "Oh, no, I didn't know that." And I said, "How about Lou Brock over there? Do any of you guys ever go to Lou Brock, who's in the Hall of Fame, and ask him maybe what you need to do to get hitters out?" So, you know, Lou was, I mean, quiet, but, you know, again, I mean, I hated guys that turned singles into doubles or triples, and that's what Lou Brock could do.
Tommy Lasorda.
Well, you know, we're in the lobby of the Otisaga, and Jane Levy had sent me a book called Koufax. It was a book that she wrote about Koufax's perfect game, and it was like, you know, nine chapters for each of the innings, and then nine chapters, you know, in between with Phil and all that kind of stuff about the background. And so I'm talking to George Kell and Yogi Berra. You know, we're hanging out in the lobby. You know how nice that is. And, you know, guys are coming in, you're there a couple of days early, and, you know, you see everybody, you see writers, you see old friends, you see, you know, everybody. So, and George Kell was, you know, probably 80 or whatever. And I said, have you read the, you know, Jane Levy Koufax book? No. And Yogi didn't read it. And Tommy comes walking up, and I said, "Hey, Tom, did you read the Koufax book?" He says, "I was as good as him." And I said, I caught myself, you know, I mean, here's Tommy, but, you know, whatever. And I mean, I had known him when he coached and he managed, you know, I did the World Series, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, whatever. So I said, "Wait a minute." I said, "Now, I knew a little bit of the history. You know, Sandy had to stay with the Dodgers, I think, in 55, maybe 56. Walter Alston wasn't happy because maybe they had better players. But that's the rule. The draft rules are, if you got over $4,000, you got to stay in the big leagues and be protected. And a lot of people don't understand this, but Tommy Lasorda in 5 years won 67 games at AAA Montreal. And he was a junk ball left-hander. And now, when he said, I could have been, or I was as good as Koufax, or I could have been as good as Koufax, he really thought that. I mean, you know, because he never got the opportunity to do that. Now, I mean, you know, Sandy pitched, what, 5 no-hitters, you know, his last year. I mean, my first World Series game was his last game ever. I mean, I think he won 27 games that year with a 1.95 ERA. You know, I mean, you know, he was a very comfortable offer, you know, because you thought you could hit that fastball that started in the lobby and ended up on the third floor. And then that same lobby fastball was a curveball and would end up in the lower basement, you know, and you go, geez. And the ball just had life and all that. But so I told Tommy, I said, see that mirror over there? Go over there, look in that mirror, and then come back here and tell me that you're as good as Sandy Koufax. Because if you are, we're going to drug test you. But, you know, Tommy was great for baseball. I mean, you know, he was a good manager. Rick Dempsey, who was one of my teammates, actually the MVP in the 83 World Series for him, played on that 88 ball club, you know, part of Hershiser's, when he pitched almost 60 scoreless innings in that, you know, a couple games in the World Series. He said Weaver was probably a better manager, but nobody treated you better than Tommy Lasorda.
Yeah,
if you were a player. Yeah.
Don Sutton.
Well, you know, Don and I mean, it's funny. We used to play an American Airlines tournament where you'd play with a football player. We'd play in Palm Springs. We'd play in Hawaii. We play all over the world. And, you know, they'd have their people come in and all that. And Don and I would always play catch. You know, we'd play the golf and we'd, you know, we'd have a football partner. One year I had John Hadel. You know, one year I had Burt Jones. I mean, I had, you know, had different guys. I had, you know, I roomed with Ray Nitschke's once. Jimmy, where do you want me to sleep? I said, Ray, you can sleep anywhere you want. You know, and I had these nightmares that he was going to tackle me in the middle of the night. But Don and I always knew that. But, you know, it's funny about, 324 wins, never missed a start. Great curveball. You know, he could. So the one game that I needed to win was the last game of 1982. You know, if we win that game, we came back from like 7 or 8 or 9 games against the Brewers. We scored 9 runs in 2 ball games and 6 runs in another one. And I'm pitching against Sutton on Sunday afternoon. I'm 15-4. If I win that game, I probably win another Cy Young Award. You know, they had taken me out of the lineup because I had a stiff neck. Hank Peters said, I never want him to start another game. And then 2 weeks later, they said, well, we need a starter. And Cal Ripken Sr. said, well, we got a guy going to the Hall of Fame out in the bullpen. So I won like 11 games in a row. So, you know, I wasn't Jim Palmer of maybe when I was 25 or 27, but I could pitch and change speeds, kind of what Don did. And you know, Don ended up winning the game, pitched well, you know, really well. I threw 3 solo home runs. We didn't score any runs. I think we lost 9-2. Bullpen came in and gave up a bunch of runs. But, you know, the ultimate professional. And the interesting thing is, you know, I was pitching in Milwaukee and the Dodgers, Don's playing for the Dodgers as he did, I don't know, 12, 13, 14, 15 years. And he comes up to Milwaukee and, you know, I pitched like 7 2/3 innings and ice in my elbow and he comes in and, you know, we're talking and he says, you ever scuff the ball? And I said, no. He said, well, it's not that hard. All you need is a little sandpaper on your left hand and you know, you take some super glue and all that. So about 10 days later, you know, I'm trying to work on super glue and a little 180 sandpaper or whatever. And all it did was take the skin off my left hand because I never rubbed the ball up. And Don would always rub the ball up. And I always thought if you're going to throw 130 to 50 to 60 to 70 pitches, which is what we did back then, I don't want to be rubbing up baseballs. You know, if you didn't feel good, you know, if it was slick or whatever, you throw it back and you do it in a hurry so the umpires will like you. But once again, I mean, Don Sutton, I mean, you know, beat me in the one game. Everybody thinks you just kind of, it's like 4-wheel drive. You just pitch a button and you win the big games. But he won the big game that day. And the other thing is, before the game started, he actually came over the bullpen and, you know, we shook hands and all that because we were friends. Yeah. So class guy. And, you know, I mean, I only saw him 3 years ago and, you know, didn't, you know, probably all the way back to 2002. He had told me he had some issues with cancer, told me I should get a body scan, which I did because you listen to Don Sutton. But it, once again, you know, a marvelous pitcher. But I mean, how do you pitch 776 straight starts and never miss a start? Longevity. And you know, I think he won 20 games 3 times. So marvelous pitcher.
Henry Aaron.
Well, Henry Aaron. Well, you know, the best. You know, I mean, he lived down in West Palm Beach and we'd always talk. I said, you know, do you play golf? He said, yeah. He said, but you know, my knees bother me. And I said, well, why don't I just pick you up? We'll have lunch if you want to play 3, 4, 5 holes and all that. And we never did it. But royalty. And I used to always, we used to go north with Atlanta. And, you know, I mean, I faced Henry in All-Star games and maybe at the end of his career when he was in Milwaukee. But I used to always talk to Dusty Baker, who I mean, I love. Dusty's the best, you know. And if you're a young player, I mean, I kind of saw it. I roomed with Robin Roberts when I was 19. He was 38, you know, on his way to Cooperstown, you know, ended up with, I think, 286 wins. If you're a young player and you happen to be black and, Hank had to go through all the, you know, all the racial strife and whatever. I mean, you know, a black man's going to break Babe Ruth's record and so on and so on and whatever. If you're Dusty Baker, I used to say, even when he was managing, I said, how did you learn about baseball? He said, Hank Aaron. He said, people don't realize how good a player Hank Aaron was, because I think we think of 755 home runs. But, you know, somebody said the other day, you can take away the 755 home runs and he still had 3,000 hits. You know, RBI leader, could throw, could run, humble, nice, just a special, special player. And, you know, I mean, I went through, you know, when I was 18, I went down to Thomasville, Georgia. That's where the double A and A teams for the Orioles, about 40 miles north of Tallahassee. And the Matias boys were the Hawaiian kids out of Hawaii. And John Matias had hit 405 in rookie league, didn't even win the batting title. Tony Oliva won it. So we could try to go get haircuts in Thomasville, Georgia. And they're not black, but they're brown enough. And the guy said, oh, I can't do that. I said, no, they're from Hawaii. And he almost cut their hair. So, so I made the club in 65. A year later, we go to Kansas City. They won't allow the black players to stay at the Mule Box. So we go stay in Kansas. So, I mean, I never had to deal with that, but I cannot imagine what Hank Aaron had to go through. And, but again, just, I mean, he was Hank Aaron. You know, it's hard to, it's kind of like if you meet, you know, the president, or if you meet, you know, a king or a queen or something like that, they're just royalty. And again, he was such a nice man. But, you know, at the All-Star game in 72, I'm starting and we're having a meeting, Lowledge and Gaylord Perry. Gaylord had just come out of the National League and he's going over the hitters, and we're in Atlanta, and Gaylord says, when we finish the meeting, he says, you know, somebody's going to have to let Hank hit a home run tonight. And I said, let him hit a home run? I said, he's already hit like 685 or 90. I said, you think those guys wanted him to hit it? Well, anyway, so, you know, I pitched three scoreless innings. I think Mickey pitched pretty well. And then Gaylord gave up a home run to Hank. But the interesting thing about, and it wasn't, you know, wasn't a hanging slider or a fastball that would play. It was a fastball up and in. And Hank did what he did to Davey Johnson, my teammate, who never hit more than 18 home runs and went to Atlanta and hit 43, I believe.
Yep.
42 as a second baseman. Taught him to hit the ball inside fair. And if you want to talk, you know, if you talk about Killebrew, if you talk about Frank Robinson, Richie Allen, they wouldn't hook that ball foul. They would stay inside the ball, but still hit home runs. You know, everybody talks about staying inside the ball, and you can, you know, Cal's best years when he hit 340. I mean, you know, inside out, so he could drive the ball to right field. But Hank could hit that ball fair, and that's exactly what he did. Gaylord made a good pitch. He probably hit it right up on the trade back mark, hit it right down the line, ball carried in Atlanta, and Hank Aaron had a home run. Not that he had any problem hitting them, of course.
And last one for you, Tom Seaver.
Well, Tom, I mean, in fact, I signed some autographs this morning, and the only Sports Illustrated cover I was on was shared with Tom Seaver. You know, 1975, I'd hurt my elbow the year before, but I had the best year I ever had, you know, with 25 complete games and 10 shutouts, 209 ERA and 23 wins. But I think when you look at all the players that have passed away, whether it's, you know, Whitey Ford or, who was one of the great big game pitchers, had a lifetime ERA of 275, but passed away this year. What they all had in common was, I think if you were their teammates, you maybe took it for granted when you were there, but you think back and you reflect and you go, God, how good were they? And, again, going back to the baseball assistant team, well, you know, one of my favorite announcers, a guy I worked with for years in Baltimore, is Gary Thorne, and Gary's emceeing the dinner. And, we get up there, it's 30 years, they always honored him at a Yankee because that would get more people to come out and, support the baseball assistants team that Garagiola and Ralph Branca started. So we're up there and Gary's asking his questions and he says, well, Jim, by the way, he goes, when they play the highlights of the 1969, World Series, when you lost to the Mets in five games, what do you do? And I said, I walk out of the room when they're playing on ESPN, Classics. And Tom goes, Jim, it's 30 years ago. You got to let it go. But I think, you know, when Tom passed away and, you know, he and I mean, I done almost identical earned run averages. You know, he had more strikeouts. I mean, you know, he kind of resurrected baseball when, you know, along with the rest of the 69 Mets. I guess one of his greatest games was what he had 18 or 19 strikeouts and he struck out the last 10. Can you imagine? I mean, this is really what sports is all about. You know, I mean, if you watch the, the Michael Jordan, with all the six-peat or whatever it was, the three-peat and all that stuff and on and on and on, you know, you forget how good he was. But can you imagine being a fan in Shea Stadium when he struck out the last 10 on his way to 19? Or if you're his teammate to watch that, I mean, do you realize how hard that is to do? So I always had great respect for Tom and, you know, great sense of humor. I mean, I went up with Fred Bamford, who used to do our radio and TV, and we go up to see him at his vineyard. And we get out of the car, and Steve Traxel, you know, he's pitched for the Mets, and now he's pitching for the Orioles. And Tom comes walking up out of the front door, and he goes, Steve Traxel, throw the ball. So smart. Extremely talented. And you know what? I mean, he changed the way people looked at baseball, you know, when they looked at if you're a Met fan. And you know what? If you go back in retrospect, we beat him in game one and then we never won any of the other games. Probably a good thing for baseball that because we won the next year against the Reds. Probably a good thing for baseball that the Miracle Mets actually did beat us in 1969, even though at the moment Earl Weaver and the rest of us weren't particularly happy.
Jim, I feel bad for you and the other Hall of Famers, Johnny Bench. You know, the next time you guys get together in Cooperstown, you know what a void that'll be. So, but I appreciate your memories. I knew you'd have stories on all these guys. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. And you know, but this is part of the game. You know, I mean, that's the thing. It's part of life, and you know, you talk about it, try to rationalize it. But I think it's Buster. To be honest, you know, it's funny. The next time you see somebody you love or a good friend of yours, you know, give them a hug because you never know if you're going to see them again. I mean, and that's just the way it is. And, you know, it's funny when you start thinking about these players, they're all the way from what, about 75 to 86. And I just turned 75. So, you know, one day they'll be talking about me and hopefully that won't happen for a while. But, you know, I think the bottom line is, you know, you just go back and the great thing, and I've been able to pretty much keep my mental faculties. It's great to be able to remember what these players were able to do and how much joy they gave to baseball fans around the world.
Jumping into the numbers.
After evaluating millions of pieces of data in the blink of an eye, the winner is Cincinnati by 200 points. Why, you worthless hunk of junk.
This is Hembo Knows.
And Hembo is Paul Embiid. He's a researcher at ESPN who's the honcho on the show Get Up. He tells us he's the head honcho. Mike Greenberg says that he's a wild partier that he would love to emulate. And it's clear, Hembo, that you must have had some partying last night because you're wearing your Phillies pajamas today.
Buster, this is a day to party. The life of a Phillies fan has been pretty miserable over the last 10 years, but Phillies did re-sign JT Realmuto yesterday for a lot less money than I may have thought a year ago. So we're happy to have the player back. He's probably the most popular player on the team right now, to be honest with you. And hashtag sign JT has trended all over the place for so long. So getting this done was wonderful. And I'm celebrating like we won the World Series because obviously we're nowhere close to that and haven't been for quite some time.
I don't know if it's going to work out, but I was saying before to Jeff Passan that, look, considering where they were, you know, probably either the fourth or fifth best team in the division, they either needed to completely turn it over again and start a rebuild or they need to spend to try to win. What did you think?
Yes. Yes, because threading the needle is very difficult. Yep. I've argued for a very long time that, you know, giving him upwards of $200 million would have been a bad decision because of all the holes on the roster. But the market has become so suppressed that this was absolutely worth doing. And we talked about on the podcast a couple of weeks ago how much better in relation to other catchers he is. That's certainly clear. I also looked at some numbers to indicate that, you know, catchers between the ages of 30 and 35 sort of do retain their value somewhat well. I think in order to justify this, he's probably going to have to put together something like 15 WAR, 3 per season over that time. And 24 different catchers have done that. And he's probably more athletic than most all of them. So I like his chances to retain the value there. And because the Phillies can spend, my hope is that we don't do another Matt Klentak type rebuild, because most Philadelphia fans just can't stomach that.
We just talked to Jim Palmer. We asked him about Henry Aaron. Give me a favorite stat of Henry Aaron that you like.
So you asked for one. I have to give you three because this is what I do. But the first one, everyone knows very well, and that's that he is the only member of the 500 home run club for whom you could subtract every home run, and he still have 3,000 hits. It's an extraordinary number. My second number I love is that 47 different players, Buster, in the history of baseball hit more home runs than he ever did in a season. His single season high was 47. And we, of course, know that only one person has exceeded his career total and had to cheat to do it. And the last number I like, which you sort of had me look this up, because there was so much talk last week of his extraordinary hitting feats, but you kept mentioning this guy could really hit, and this guy could really run, and this guy could really field. And you're right, Buster. I use Baseball Reference's WAR formula. In doing so, Hank Aaron combined to produce 142 runs of value from just his fielding and base running. I'm going to list a handful of players who accrued less than him. Larry Walker, Honus Wagner, Alan Trammell, Tris Speaker, Ryan Sandberg, and Joe DiMaggio, among many, many others. He was an all-time great player in totality, and he was just such a great hitter that it's often forgotten because of that number 755.
What do you think of nobody getting in the Hall of Fame this year?
Well, because the public balloting is such that, it's rendered almost nothing a surprise, but that doesn't make it any less disappointing. The Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens thing is pretty clear. Those guys have no chance of getting in right now, given the stagnation of their growth, and also given the fact that the electorate really has no idea what to do with the character clause. The biggest story for me coming out of yesterday was Curt Schilling, who I guess sort of fittingly posted on Facebook afterwards that he doesn't want to be involved in the vote in the future, even though I think there's a really good chance that should he stay on the ballot, he'll get elected next year, because making up 16 votes is really easy. And I think we've long thought that the electorate was almost punishing him until his last year. And that seems to be pretty clear. And my last point would be, it's very clear to me that Scott Rolen is on his fast track to the Hall of Fame. He took a significant jump. I went back and looked, Buster, among all the last 80 years, players to receive between 50 and 75% of the vote in year four, which he just did, every single one of them, aside from Curt Schilling, wound up getting in by the writers. I think there were 17 previous instances. So this was a candidate who I didn't think had much of a chance even 2 years ago. He is on the fast track to the Hall of Fame right now. And there's only been 8 third basemen elected by the writers.
Yeah, jumped out to Tim Kirkjian how much Scott Rolen's numbers jumped up this year. You sent me some really interesting numbers after George Springer signed with the Toronto Blue Jays at age 31 for 6 years, $150 million.
Yeah, everyone was gushing over this contract, and he's an outstanding player now, one of the best fastball hitters in the sport, and will most definitely make that lineup a lot better in the short term. But from the perspective of his contract, it's not one that profiles all that well moving forward. So he became the 8th position player to sign a $100 million free agent contract at 31 or older. That's how old he is right now. The others were Yoenis Cespedes with the Mets, Robinson Cano with the Mariners, Shin-Soo Choo with the Rangers, Josh Hamilton with the Angels, Albert Pujols with the Angels, Jason Worth with the Nationals, and Alex Rodriguez with the Yankees. That's a mouthful, but in order to interpret it, those players combined to average fewer than 2.5 WAR per season with those clubs during the life of the contract. Most of those contracts were washes. You could argue that none of them actually worked out for the club, and you can certainly argue that most of them clearly did not. So I think George Springer has a chance to age fairly well, but years 4, 5, definitely 6, those are going to be wash years. And at that point, you think that they're going to want to have those young players locked up long term. So it helps them out a lot right now, but that's the best you can say.
An important part of the conversation, I think, for the Yankees or the Blue Jays or the White Sox is the fact that I've mentioned this to people, that we've had winters in which the talent shift has been from the National League to the American League, but it feels like it's going the other direction this winter.
It does, Buster. Now, I went back and looked at the free agent dollars, and there have been more free agent dollars assigned to American League clubs this offseason, but the trade market and some of the top-tier players have gone flooding to the National League. We know last year that the Dodgers and the Padres were probably the two best teams during the regular season, at least by run differential. And I went back and looked. The National League has not only gained ground on the American League, but even in the last few seasons, it's done so. So the American League is 48 games under 500 with a minus 277 run differential in the early games. That's the last 3 years. They had won head-to-head series in each of the previous 14 seasons by nearly 350 games. So this was a trend that definitely surprised me. The American League obviously has traditionally been stronger and better in interleague because of the designated hitter. But those are pretty loud numbers over the last 3 years, and I'm not sure it's going to get any quieter, because I think right now you could credibly argue that the two teams out west and the two teams in the east, the Braves and the Mets, those might be the four best clubs in baseball. The Yankees have done a lot lately, but four of the five best teams in baseball on paper right now, in my opinion, are in the National League.
And I totally agree with you, which is a really scary thought. All right, Hembo, you know, put on your Phillies footies as you go through your day.
Hey, we're going 70-92. Later, boys.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster, Bleacher Tweets for Wednesday. First up, we have our pal Brian Stone King at Brian Stone King, who I believe used to be School of Sweat. I think he officially changed his name on Twitter.
What's up with that?
I don't know. I don't like it. I don't like it, Brian.
Please. I like School of Sweat. Yeah.
Same.
Let's go back to that.
please. He writes in, why can't the National Baseball Hall of Fame create its own voting team? It's not owned by Major League Baseball, right? Let the writers vote for seasonal awards. Hall of Fame should be voted on by a separate committee that doesn't hold grudges or have access to grind. Who should I call? You floated out kind of a different idea than this, but what do you think about School of Sweat's proposal?
Yeah, so a lot of people, when I say, you know, the writers shouldn't be involved in this and they should seed the ground, people say, well, what system should it be? I mean, you could go with players, you could go with a committee, school. I think that's totally, you know, those are totally reasonable. I just don't think the journalists should be in the business of deciding character. I just don't. I think that whatever system they come up with that gets the writers out of that box would be really important. And something to just to note on the major awards, the Baseball Writers Association of America owns those awards. The Hall of Fame owns the plaques and the process and the whole thing. And that's why I think the writers can't control that. And they need to take more control about how this is playing out.
It's funny, Buster, you know this. When people from outside the baseball world, sports world, they're like, oh, no one got voted into the Hall of Fame. Journalists, famously sanctimonious bunch of people. So it's funny to explain that to folks who don't live it every day. Next up, we've got Mitchell at Tigers of Detroit writes in, large contracts for 30-plus-year-old position players have rarely worked out. What is the last $100 million free agent contract that worked out for a team? Any idea on this one?
Well, we just heard from Paul Hembekides. He had that list of players over 30. You know, I let's face it. I remember when Hembo sent me that list the other day after George Springer signed. I posted it on Twitter, and so many people were like, what are you trying to say? You're trying to say they never work out. Most of the time, they don't work out, which right. is why when you get to the end of a contract, and Max Scherzer was not over 30 when he signed his deal, but there's pride for Max Scherzer, for a John Lester, who gave production basically all the way through the contract. It doesn't happen often.
Last one up for today. Eric Keller at Keller_Eric writes in, the Pirates have traded away all their talent, but don't appear to be tanking. Is there hope in this strategy?
Eric, I guess it would depend on how you define tanking. I looked it up this morning. The Pittsburgh Pirates, beyond the 2021 season, have a total of $3 million committed to future contracts. $3 million. Whoa. In total. I don't know if you want to use the word tanking. I would use the word tanking.
Yeah. It's not so bad, Eric. It's bad, but not as bad as you portrayed in your tweet there. Thanks for writing in, everyone. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. And please subscribe to, rate, and review this podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts.
My thanks to Jim Palmer and to Tim Kirchin, Jeff Passan, and Taylor Schwenk. Paul Hembekides also. Have a great day, everybody. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something we need to fight against every single day.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.